there are three great tax benefits to real estate ownership: your mortgage interest deduction, you've got your depreciation, which is a non-cash deduction, and then finally your 1031 exchange.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll. Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. I'm your host, Tate Duryea, with my wonderful co-host, Ryan Gibson. How are you doing, my man?
I'm doing great, Tate, and excited to introduce our listeners to another pilot who's also out there doing great things in the real estate investing world.
Yeah, our conversation with Trevor Floor was absolutely incredible. I met this guy actually through Austin Hulbert. So if you've listened to, I think, episode 2-ish, Austin was on the show. Trevor's incredible. He's a fellow F-18 pilot, former F-18 pilot. He now flies a heavy for one of the majors. And he's got an incredible real estate background. He's a 1031 exchange advisor. He's got an MBA in real estate. He's a real estate investment consultant. And he currently is at DAI Securities, where he is involved with DSTs, or Delaware Statutory Trust. So, Ryan, you want to tell us a little bit more about what you thought about the conversation and DSTs?
I'm so excited, and here's why. Because for the longest time, I've wondered how you can take 1031 exchange money and legitimately roll it into a syndication. Well, the answer is you can't. So, but then you see people doing it and you're like, how do they do it? And then Trevor walks us through like the different ways you can actually do it. So I scraped the internet far and wide and could not find a great answer. I found wrong answers. I found kind of half answers. And here's the other thing too. I think investors are doing this in syndications. I think a lot of syndications are doing it wrong, or they're not doing it in the best structure. So in this episode, if you're ever wondering, like, can I sell my rental properties and roll them into a syndication? The answer is yes, depending on the structure. And Trevor is the most to the point, well-explained person in this topic. So I think the listeners are really going to enjoy this episode, especially if you're thinking about 1031ing your capital into a deal with other institutional quality investment.
Yeah, and there's some interesting restrictions to it. The long answer is you can 1031 one deal to the next, or you can 1031 a rental property into a syndication, but it's a very, very complex structure without the DST. And it involves a tenant in common agreement. It's sort of an adjunct to the syndication. It comes with all sorts of strings that are attached to it. The DST simplifies all of this, but there are a few drawbacks as well, which we get into. So I'm excited to dive into this. Let's get to the show. Trevor, thank you so much for coming on the show, man.
Tate, Ryan, thanks. Happy to be here.
Yeah, you've got an incredible background. Can we get some little bit of background, flying stories, and how you got where you are?
Yeah, man. So I grew up in a suburb of Minneapolis, but after some flying experience during high school through Civil Air Patrol, I kind of abandoned the ambition to fly professionally. I ended up moving out to Southern California. And during school, I became a professional real estate agent. I was focused on residential property. And when I graduated my undergrad at UC Santa Barbara, I actually started my own brokerage. So I was focused exclusively on real estate at that time. I had three agents that were reporting to me and was expanding the business to include some commercial deals. Then went into commercial real estate as an underwriter, essentially, on the acquisitions team for a large portfolio company that was focused on medical office properties. So we were buying up properties across the United States. Don't worry, I'm getting to the aviation part. But I was off course on my aviation career up till this point. But I really just kind of woke up one morning in 2007 and thought, man, that flying I did in high school and my time in Civil Air Patrol, I really missed that. And I went and I talked to a recruiter. If anyone knows Santa Barbara, the Navy recruiting office is right on the ocean on Cabrillo Boulevard in Santa Barbara. And I'm looking at the ocean and I'm talking to a Navy recruiter who's telling me about all these great flying opportunities you have in the Navy. And I said, sign me up. And shortly after, was headed to OCS. So did OCS, Officer Candidate School in the Navy, commissioned as an officer and went to flight school. Ended up being able to fly my chosen aircraft, the F-18 Super Hornet. Did that operationally in Japan. So I lived in Japan and cruised the South Pacific for 6 months a year for about a 3-year period. And then ended up wrapping my time in the Navy at VFA 106, which is the replacement air group, instructing new and returning F-18 pilots before we sent them to the fleet. So probably a little off your aviation background, but that's my story. And I separated from the Navy in 2017.
No, that's what we're all about here is, you know, entrepreneurs turned pilots turned entrepreneurs, whatever it might be. We love it. And we love that you're sharing your story with us. And we're going to get into some cool topics today. So excited about that.
Yeah. And I understand you're with the airlines now, 6 years in the airline industry?
That's right. Yeah, I evaluated that. I actually did a couple of graduate programs. The GI Bill was available to me as I was exiting the active service. So I was able to get an MBA and I was convinced I was going to go to work for a consulting firm or get back into real estate on a full-time basis. And as I evaluated options, there just wasn't a better option than continuing my career as a professional pilot.
It's hard to beat, right?
It's hard to beat. So I ended up thinking, well, I can do, you know, I can follow both of my passions, you know, real estate and flying. So I went to work for a major airline, and I consider that my side job, but it can sometimes, you know, on some months be my main job.
Boy, I can relate to that.
Yeah, but that keeps me busy on occasion, and most of the time I'm taking calls and writing emails from the hotel rooms if I end up on a layover.
Where are you right now? Where are you right now, if you don't mind sharing?
Yeah, I don't mind at all. I'm in New York City right now. I'm based in New York City, so we have a place here, and I'm looking outside to, I don't know if you've seen headlines, but the wildfires up in Quebec, Canada have a big smoke cloud that had blown over. So it looks like it's foggy and stormy, but it's just a massive smoke cloud over New York right now.
I heard that. Yeah. So are you in the crash pad?
In the crash pad.
Nice.
Yeah.
We'll have a whole episode on crash pads if you're looking.
Yeah, nice.
You don't know what that is. Well, a lot of pilots know what that is. So
tell us what you're doing now. Yeah. And we'll get to the meat here. So
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I had done that MBA program as I transitioned out, and then when I ended up at the major airline, I had a lot of time on my hands, and I still had some GI Bill money left over. So I thought, well, I'll go do a master's in real estate as well. And I ended up at Fordham University in New York City for a year and a half in person, full time program, and I was wrapping that up through a personal connection, a founder and CEO of a securities broker dealer who's headquartered in Atlanta, Georgia, was introduced to me as they were at that time looking to expand their due diligence department. So they're a very focused securities firm on real estate investments, specifically the DST or Delaware Statutory Trust, which I think we'll have a chance to talk more about. So I went to work on his team for about 2 years. I evaluated the properties that would go into the DST structure. I'd do site visits, tenant interviews, sponsor interviews, evaluate underwriting, do financial stress testing. And I got so comfortable and familiar with the structure, I thought, man, this would be fun to go and actually talk to clients about. So I got my securities licenses in about 3.5 years ago now, and have since transitioned over to work exclusively with clients. So I'm a financial advisor that specializes in really three pillars of real estate. First, the DSTs that are often suitable for a client who's pursuing a 1031 exchange. The second pillar is qualified opportunity zones, which we could do a full episode on those as well. very interesting tax advantages related to QOZs. And then finally, just straight syndicated real estate deals. So we work with a lot of developers, distressed buyers, and other real estate operators who just look to raise capital for their program. So I work with clients across the spectrum of those three areas, but all focused on real estate deals.
That's great. A particular interest, we just are offering our investors a new type of structure that allows them to roll their proceeds from the sale of another property and defer the taxes. So, obviously when investors have a rental property, let's say they buy it for $100,000, they're selling it for $200,000, there might be $100,000 worth of profit that they're going to end up paying taxes on. And what we wanted to do at Spartan was come up with a structure that allowed investors to be able to invest in something that allowed them to defer those taxes. Now, before we start throwing out all these, confusing terms like 1031 exchange and DST and trust and beneficiary and, trustee and all this stuff, would you mind just kind of being walking through it like nobody's ever heard of one of these things before? And just kind of talk about, maybe why? Like, why have these vehicles been set up and how can people participate in them?
Yeah, great question, Ryan. So I think it's important first, like you said, to frame the problem. So what is the problem we're looking to solve? And the problem really is a tax-related problem. If we think about tax, and I know you've had other guests that have spoken, very specifically about parts of the tax code related to real estate ownership, just to understand why tax is a problem. If you think about your income tax, for example, the individual income tax rate maxes out at 37%. Your FICA taxes, which do age out after $160,000 of income, those are another 7.5%. You add state income tax onto that, and potentially you're paying an exceedance of 40% of your income on taxes. If you can think of another expense item across the board that takes 40% of your income, I don't have one. Any single expense in my portfolio of expenses doesn't exceed 40%. So it's a huge problem, and we haven't even talked about sales tax, property tax, capital gain tax. So we need to look as pilots, you're speaking to a very specific audience of high W-2 earned income earners, and we need to look for opportunities where we can mitigate some of the stress of our tax burden. So real estate ownership is kind of a perfect investment for these high W-2 wage earners because there are tax efficiencies built in. I always talk about there are three great tax benefits to real estate ownership: your mortgage interest deduction, you've got your depreciation, which is a non-cash deduction, and then finally your 1031 exchange. Of course, there are others like your rep status or real estate professional status and cost seg studies, but those three I think really represent across syndications the best three tax benefits for real estate ownership. So when we get to that 1031 exchange, what we are seeing is an opportunity for the investor to sell an interest in a qualifying piece of real estate and defer the capital gain to a future date, at which time we say they exit the exchange chain. So just on the capital gains front, why it's important to manage our capital gains burden, and if this is too technical, stop me, but I think this is a good way to demonstrate how dilutive this is to wealth creation. Capital gains tax, if we take a penny and we double the penny every day for 30 days, at the end of that exercise, you're going to have about $5.4 million. If you do that same exercise and you charge a 30% capital gain tax every time you double, your balance at the end of that exercise is about $80,000. So it's 65 times higher to end up in a situation where we avoid the capital gain tax. Now, that's a very extreme example. Obviously, if you know someone that can double my money 30 times in my lifetime, shut up and take my money. But it demonstrates how divergent the pathways are to wealth creation between those options that incur a capital gain tax and those that don't. So what I like to tell my clients is, not only in real estate, but in all my portfolio investments, let's look for ways to minimize or avoid capital gain tax. That might mean holding an asset longer, like a stock or a bond, taking on a longer term position where we're not selling frequently and incurring a capital gain tax. Or in real estate, it means taking advantage of the 1031 exchange. I'm going to pause there because I've been talking for a while. Am I hitting on some of the context we want to talk about?
Yeah, that's absolutely great. And just for 1031, you know, how many lines of tax code are there? It's like 2000 or something. I don't know. Maybe it's probably
something like that.
Yeah. So 1031 is just, it's the section of the tax code. That's what all that is. It's section 1031. And it deals with exchanging property for other property. And people say like kind property and, you know, identification period, all these confusing things. At the end of the day, it's like you're selling one piece of property for another. And when you have a profit, that profit gets taxed and you can roll the tax in as so long as you buy another property within a certain time window. That's the most basic way of kind of understanding it.
And let's touch on the specificities of the 1031 real quick, because it'll come into play when we talk about the DSTs. You have, 45 days to identify and then 180 days to close, right? So if you're going to do a 1031 exchange, right, I'll let you walk through it.
Yeah, so Ryan, you're absolutely right. So a 1031 exchange, section of the tax code that defines our ability to perform a like-kind exchange. The tax code actually has been around since the early 1920s. It's changed a number of times. Most recently, in 2017, they eliminated the 1031 exchangeability of personal property. So now we can only exchange interests in real estate, qualifying real estate. And essentially what we're doing is we're selling an interest in real estate. We would refer to that property we sell as the relinquished property. And then we're rolling those proceeds into a new property, which we'll refer to as the replacement property. So we've got the relinquished and the replacement. The timelines, Tate, that you referred to are 45 days to identify, and that clock begins on the day of closing on our relinquished property. So when we sell our relinquished, 45 days later, we have to submit an identification worksheet to the third party that is holding our proceeds. That party is called a qualified intermediary. Often we'll find title companies will perform that service of a qualified intermediary or a QI. There are also standalone companies that perform those services. But we'll submit by the 45th day an identification sheet if we haven't closed on our replacement property yet. And that identification sheet will give us an additional 135 days to, in fact, close on the replacement properties. But the gotcha there is in that 135 days, we can only close on a property that we have identified. So where we see a lot of exchanges fail is someone is up against their, a client may be up against their 45th day deadline, and they're unable to find a suitable replacement property. So they identify a couple things. They go on to do the due diligence on those replacement properties and they find flaws or, you know, pricing issues, or there's a problem getting financing from the bank. So they can't actually close. In that case, their exchange is broken. They can't complete the exchange at that point. So I always say it's never too early to start the process of exploring your replacement property options, but I certainly like to engage with a client 30 days before they close on their relinquished sale so that we have enough time to explore options, because that that 45 days goes by pretty quick.
And you can only identify up to three properties, just to clarify.
So there's actually, that's the most commonly used rule, but there's actually three different rules that you can use to identify. The first and most common is the one you referenced, Tate. So you can identify three properties regardless of their value. The second rule that I use a lot in my world is called the 200% rule. And in the 200% rule, we can identify any number of properties as long as the collective value of those properties doesn't exceed 200% of the fair market value of the relinquished property that you're selling. So if you're selling a property for $1 million, we can identify any number of properties that together add up to no more than $2 million under the 2% rule. I'm sorry, the 200% rule. And then the final rule is very seldom used. It's called the 95% rule. And all that says is that we can identify any number of properties and any value as long as we close on 95% of them. Very few circumstances where that rule would be necessary, so we just don't see it a lot, but it's there.
That would mean that if you use the unlimited number of properties, that doesn't exceed the 200%. So you're relinquishing $1 million property, and we're going to identify, let's say, 10 properties that are under 2 million. You'd have to close on a lot of those, though, in order to make your exchange work, right? Because whatever additional capital gain that you don't use is considered what boot, right? And you're subject to capital gain. So you'd have to, even if you identified a lot, you'd have to close on a lot, right? Because you can't identify a bunch of replacement $1 million properties.
Yeah. So you're touching on one of the great benefits of the structure I hope we talk about, the Delaware Statutory Trust.
Right.
Because one of the unique benefits of the DST, because it's a syndicated option that's allowed under Section 1031 as replacement property, we can actually diversify the client across many properties. And therefore, we could put them into a portfolio of 10 different DST properties and only identify a $200,000 sliver of each one of those 10 properties, where together we're not exceeding the 200% rule, but we have an opportunity to invest that client in any one of those 10 properties. So it's a very useful tool for us in the world of DST.
Amazing. So yeah, let's jump into DSTs. Ryan, I know you want to get in here, and Ryan has become a consummate expert on these because I know Spartan has their first DST.
Enough to be dangerous, that's all.
going on right now. But I want to make sure that we unpack this carefully and from the right spot, because when I was first introduced to DSTs, I was invited to a pitch about a year ago. Sat at Morton's, and someone was up there giving a presentation on these DSTs, and it was all about the benefits of rolling your relinquished property into DSTs and blah, blah, blah. And it's great. And it's going to be, you know, we only work with great operators. For someone that understands syndications, it's very confusing because it's like, well, how does this differ from a GPLP structure? So anyway, I wanted to, you know, turn it over to you and Ryan, I know you're dying to get in here as well, but I want to kind of go from square one, identify the problem, like why can't we 1031 exchange into syndications and how is DST a solution to it? And then let's unpack the whole thing.
Yeah. So I'm going to hit that point you mentioned first, Tate, as a way to demonstrate. So part of the requirement under Section 1031 is that we're buying real estate. And I think the framing in the tax code is actually a direct ownership of real estate. And what a lot of investors may not realize is that when you invest in a GPLP structure, usually what you own are typically membership interests in an LLC or in the partnership. You don't directly own that property. And so for that reason, under Section 1031, most, if not all, syndications that aren't one of two structures that we'll talk about are not qualifying under Section 1031 as direct ownership in real estate. So that you're hitting it on the head that there's a ton of demand going back to the 90s and 80s of customers that were performing 1031 exchanges and didn't want the headaches of direct management. All the reasons why your passive income focus is speaking to investors, they don't want the management responsibility. They want maybe a fractional ownership of a larger asset. They want access to types of properties they may not have access to. So all the great reasons to participate in a syndication, the 1031 exchange investor was also seeking those solutions. So the demand was building. In 2002, a structure was created called a TIC, a Tenants in Common. Has that come up on the show yet?
I don't think we've talked about it much. Let's briefly touch on it.
Yeah, so a TIC was the first allowed syndication structure under Section 1031. The IRS issued a revenue ruling in 2004, kind of ordained that an acceptable replacement property solution under 1031. And that became kind of the in vogue option for syndication under Section 1031. The problems with that structure started to evolve during the global financial crisis because you have a couple unique challenges with the TIC. The first is you're limited to 35 investors. And so already, you know, if you want to go after a $50 million property, you have to find 35 investors that are each exchanging more than $1 million in order to take that property down. So you're already limited in what you can acquire under a TIC structure. The second is that the TIC members, so those 35 investors who don't know each other, are all required to vote on operating decisions. So there's a TIC manager that has to go to them and say, hey, do you want to sell this property or do you want to keep owning it? And I have clients that have massive disagreements with their one sibling about what to do with the estate that they inherited. Imagine getting 35 investors to unify around a operating decision of this asset. So that was particularly highlighted in leading into the global financial crisis, where the TIC manager was saying, we see problems in the economy, let's sell the asset. And a lot of the TIC members were refusing to sell the asset, and they ended up in foreclosure, you know, as the loans would come due and they couldn't refinance. So those structures became very, they went from very favorable to very unfavorable through the global financial crisis. There are some other unique characteristics. The banks didn't like lending to TICs as well, because you have to individually underwrite each investor of the TIC, which became very problematic for banks on an administrative level. You'd have to underwrite 35 individuals to lend on a single asset. So, of course, during the global financial crisis, when they were calling out their, you know, their support staff, there wasn't really an ability to do that. So those three reasons are the big ones. But in 2004, so shortly after the TIC was approved, they had approved a second structure, syndication structure, that was permitted under Section 1031, and that's the DST. It's a Delaware Statutory Trust. It's a mouthful of a name, but all it means is that it's a trust organized under statutory trust laws in the state of Delaware. It's specifically referenced in an IRS revenue ruling called 2004-86, and in that revenue ruling, it lays out the requirements that if the DST structure meets these certain requirements, that it is permissible under Section 1031 to be used as a replacement property. So they're going to treat, the IRS is going to treat that investment as a direct ownership in the real estate. And so when 2007 kind of, you know, ruined the appeal of the TIC structure, the DST kind of replaced it. And the DST solves a number of our problems. And we'll start with the most obvious, where we no longer rely on our investors to make operating decisions. So we have a sponsor, the professional real estate company that's managing the syndication. They now are making all their management decisions. So there's that kind of cuts two ways if you think about it, because some investors like a little control of the asset. Under the DST structure, that's not permitted. So the sponsor is making all the decisions around the operation and the asset management of that property, and the investor is just kind of sitting back entirely passive. The second is it lifted the restriction on number of investors. So instead of 35, we now can have up to 2,000 investors. And so we're really opening ourselves up to a whole new caliber and price point of real estate assets we can put into this structure. And then the third is all the debt that goes on the asset has to be non-recourse to the investor. So the investor is not taking on any personal guarantee or any risk against the debt that's placed on the asset. So for that reason, the most the investor can lose is the initial equity that they invest. There is no bank that's ever going to come after the investor if there's a default situation or if there is a capital call, because one of the requirements under DST is we can't actually do a capital call. Let me pause there because there are a couple other unique restrictions about the DST, but any kind of follow-up thoughts on that before I talk about some of the other specifications?
I just want to say thank you. That was awesome. That was like,
all right. I mean,
that, yep. Wow, you really know your stuff. That was great. I loved how you you literally walked the entire dog. I mean, that was awesome. Because a lot of times my experience in this has been, can I take 1031s into my syndication? Well, no, because you can't. You can't give like a pref and it looks too much like a partnership, right? And so the IRS doesn't allow that. That's that at the end of the day. But then you can do a TIC. You can still do a TIC. And we did four. Yep. We did four of them actually in 2021, where the investor, came in as a TIC and we split the ownership on the title of the property. And for those syndicators out there, it was a pain. It was a pain for everybody, mm-hmm. really. And can I just go on one little tangent about that, that I think really people need to understand is there is this IRS revenue ruling, which is a big deal because it really defines how distributions are split in a TIC. You can't syndicate 1031 money and then give everybody a preferred return, from the 1031 side. You have to actually give them their beneficial ownership amount as a percentage of the purchase price of the asset. So every single month, our team has to stop what they're doing, has to make a separate calculation for the 1031 investor and give them a different distribution amount based on their ownership in the asset. And if that investor has assumed some debt in the transaction, it's a different distribution than if they didn't have debt rolling over. So you can imagine the chaos it creates within your organization, like just trying to manage it. And here's one more thing I wanted to make a point on. If you're thinking about doing a syndication and accepting 1031s, you might put together your pro forma, right? And say, hey, we're raising money and this is our target. And then what you realize later on is that your pro forma to a 1031 investor is garbage because you have to adjust the ownership of the asset and give them that direct cash flow based on their ownership. And then it changes the economics for all the investors. We learned that lesson the hard way. So TICs are permissible, allowable. You can set them up, you can do it, but just know that it is messy. And so the DST is just a super clean way of just, like you said, the sponsor takes the control of the property and is the trustee of the trust, right? In other words, makes decisions. And then you can have tons of people that come in and they just take a beneficial ownership interest in the asset and everything is great. And so let's talk about some downsides to that, if you don't mind. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and there are downsides. So the first is the one we already talked about, right? Where the investor is losing control. But the other downsides are kind of an effect of some of the restrictions placed on the structure in that revenue ruling 2004-86. So one of the biggest of those challenges is we can't make significant improvements to the property. And where that impacts us, actually, let me back up real quick to say that I believe the IRS's intent with the DST was to deliver a competitor to a triple net asset for an investor, typically we'd see investors would generate growth through real estate ownership over their younger years. And then as they would approach retirement, they would be sold a triple net, you know, single tenant retail building. And that was meant to be their passive option. So I think based on what I've read, it seems they kind of modeled the DST experience on the triple net, you know, single tenant triple net property experience. So what that means is these were built and are kind of managed in a way to just be cash flow generators to the investors. So part of the restriction they placed on it is we cannot actually improve the property in a significant way. So sponsors can't go adding square footage. They can't knock down walls. They can perform light upgrades to generate some rent growth, but they're kind of limited in that way. So you're not going to see huge growth returns on a DST property typically. The second is we're unable to refinance debt under the DST. So whatever debt they put in place, and usually we see at the institutional level a debt product like a 10-year, you know, fixed interest rate loan with some period of interest only. And that's great, but it's also can be limiting based on what market conditions are doing. So if we get to the end of that 10-year period, we have to sell that asset, or I should say the sponsor has to sell that asset, or if they can't sell the asset, they actually have to exit the structure, exit the DST. That event is called a spring out, and they actually move the property into an LLC so that they can do some of these things that are not allowed under the DST rules. So that can be kind of a limiting feature to the DST structure. And the final is that as we see in any syndication, this is going to incur some fees, right? So I talk to my clients who are very fee sensitive about fees a lot, and how we have to just leave it is it's the cost of doing nothing. You can go and manage a property and be on call if the tenant needs, you know, the toilets, trash, or taxes, or you know, something handled. You can be the call they make. Or you can sit back and do nothing and collect a monthly distribution, and you're going to incur a fee for that. And it's not just for the ability to do nothing. It's for the expertise of the syndicator, of the sponsor, that we're able to kind of piggyback on their knowledge of the marketplace, relationships, institutional access to capital. We get the benefit of all those things in exchange for the fee. But we still have to incur that fee. And as you said, Ryan, that's usually built in as a fee, either an asset management fee or an acquisition disposition fee. What we can't do, another impact of that revenue ruling, we cannot, as the sponsor, participate in the benefits. So the preferred promote structure that you alluded to, that you may do under a typical syndication that's organized as a GPLP or a LLC, we are actually restricted from employing that kind of a revenue share under the DST rules. So there are some restrictions that kind of handcuffs the sponsor in what they can do. And it, for that reason, kind of funnels those sponsors into specific types of property. And if you guys want to talk about some of the properties we see, that might be a good next step. But those are some of the negatives that we have to work around in the structure.
Yeah, this is so good. So yeah. I want to kind of rehash a couple of things that you've said, and then we can move on. Ryan, I'll turn it over to you. But I want to rehash a couple of things. First of all, you said that when you invest in a normal syndication deal, say normal because they're more popular, right? There's a GPLP structure. What we mean by that is general partner, limited partner. The limited partner is the investors. The general partner is the one who's doing all the work. And you said that you don't actually own a equity piece of the property. And I want to clarify that that's okay. You know, the tax benefits still flow through to everyone. You also said triple net lease. I just want to clarify that because some people might not know what triple net is. Trevor, do you want to just talk to that real quick? And then I got a couple other things I want to.
Yeah, you got it. So yeah, triple net is and what that means is the lease that you have with the tenant is net of usually three things: net of property tax, net of insurance, and net of maintenance. So when it's net to the landlord, it means that all those, the burden of those expenses fall on the tenant. So as the owner of the property that is subject to a triple net lease, you don't have to pay any of those expenses. The tenant would incur all those costs. So you can, it's a much more predictable cash flow since we don't have any, any variation in our expenses.
Right. And that would be typically grocery stores, industrial warehouses, things like that, where it's, you're just basically
Walgreens, buying cash Starbucks.
Flow. Exactly.
Exactly right. And they're typically long-term leases, 15 plus years is not uncommon on a triple net structure. And they typically have very low annual rent escalation. So they do very poorly in periods of high inflation, like we've been in, but they do particularly well in periods of deflation or stagnation, where we see a built-in escalation even during those periods. So very, very, specific benefits. And there are clients that prefer that style of investment, but the DST solves some of those fixed rent growth problems by allowing us to invest in assets like multifamily and storage, where we can capture more rent growth than we would see under a triple net lease.
Excellent. Well, yeah. And the last thing I want to touch on here, sorry, Ryan, is just that, giving up control is also not a bad thing. You're giving up control. You're giving up the responsibility of asset managing this property. I have properties that have property managers, and it's still work because it's, at the end of the day, it's your asset. It's your choice. Like, hey, this unit got trashed. What countertops do you want to use? Here's some bids. Taxes are due, things like that. So, you were talking about the 35 investors in a TIC having voting rights. And I'm thinking, what do you think would happen if all the passengers on your airplane got to vote on what you do if you had an engine fire?
That's a great analogy.
Because
that's a great analogy.
Be all over the place.
Yeah. And that's where I see it the most is when I deal with a very sophisticated real estate owner client who's had maybe 30 years of experience owning duplexes, triplexes. I work with a lot of agriculture landowners that have operated their land. And the idea of them relinquishing control is quite scary. But you're absolutely right. If we relinquish control to somebody who doesn't know how to make those decisions, that's a problem. But part of my job is helping that client develop trust in the track record and experience of the sponsors that we work with, so they understand that these are the people that we believe and trust are going to execute on their strategy. We want to put our money behind those sponsors. So absolutely not a bad thing, but it cuts both ways. Some clients are a little scared to relinquish control for the first time.
Scared flyers.
Yeah, right. Indeed. Yeah.
If you got good pilots, then there you go. Ryan, it's all yours, man.
Spring out, man. Is that just like the loan term ends and even an extension would be considered a refinance if the bank said, hey, we'll let the loan go for another 5 years or something? Interesting.
Yeah. So we've seen this very seldomly, but there are reasons to spring out. Refinancing is the number one that I've seen, that they have some issue with the debt that requires them to either refinance or change debt terms that are so significant it would be considered a refinance. In those cases, the spring out is the only solution for the investors. And the unfortunate thing is, if you have to spring out a DST property, and this is very uncommon, but it's kind of a comforting thing for investors to know this option is there, because we can't perform a capital call under DST. So we can't go back to investors and say, give us more money. So the other, refinance being one driver of the spring out. The other is if the sponsor doesn't reserve enough operating reserves up front and they exhaust those operating reserves, they may not be able to continue operating the property without additional capital. Well, as we discussed, we can't refinance and we can't go back to investors. So shoot, what do? We have this ability to spring out. So springing out the property into an LLC allows us to do whatever we want. In that case, maybe a capital call, place additional debt or refinance the existing debt. But the unfortunate thing is once now we're in an LLC, we've terminated our ability to continue to perform in a 1031 exchange. Now, this is a part of the law. I should have made clear, I'm not a CPA, nor am I an attorney. So none of this should be construed as tax or legal advice. But I've through conversations I've had with attorneys, I do believe they have explored options to spring back in to a DST structure. And I've never seen that done before, but that option may exist to resume the ability to continue a 1031 exchange for the investor. But it's a important feature of the structure to understand that is there as a safeguard, but hopefully, you know, we've got a sponsor that doesn't need to exercise that.
So really,
that spring out.
So when you're evaluating these opportunities, you have to really be mindful of how much reserves the property's carrying, what the cash flow is every single month, maybe the break-even occupancy, and then how they've levered the property. Because if they've over-leveraged the property and they run out of money, or there is a loan on the property in general, if the loan expires, that could trip a tax event. That could be.
You're absolutely right, and you're hitting on some very critical things we look at when we evaluate sponsors and specific DST offerings. So just to give you some context, on a national level, there are about 50 sponsors that are routinely offering DST investments to the public. When we evaluate which sponsors our firm wants to partner with, the reserves, the deal structure, certainly the fee structure are very paramount to the decisions we make, because what you see with some of the sponsors we refuse to work with is they like to over-reserve up front in order to offer a higher distribution to the investor. So they'll say, hey, we can pay you a 6% distribution in the first year of this DST. But when we really dig into the financial forecasting they provide, we see they've over-raised reserves and they intend to withdraw reserves to pay that distribution, which means
they're paying you back your own money.
Exactly right. And not only they're paying you back your own money, but they've charged you. There's a sales load and there's organization costs to these. So they've charged you a load and they're just giving your money back with the expectation that rent growth in the early years will help, close that gap, which is a huge risk itself, because maybe we don't achieve the rent growth or the NOI, the net operating income increases that we project. And then not only are we down, we've dwindled down our reserve account, but we're having to do a distribution cut anyway in 3 years because the property can't support the projections we made. So there are a lot of tricks. I mean, these are complicated structures to begin with, but there are a lot of tricks that we see in the marketplace. And if we have any suspicion that those kind of games are being played, it's not a sponsor we work with.
Okay, I got a question for both you and Ryan. It seems that the inbound channels to DSTs seem to be different than typical GPLP syndications, right? So
yeah,
if you want to invest in a DST, it usually comes through a financial advisor or something like that, where they are bringing a solution to a financial client of theirs, versus syndications that are out there in the world where people are looking to place capital and they have some sort of a education and marketing engine. They're like, hey, we're investing in this real estate and we're raising capital for it. Can you guys talk to that to us about that? Like, what, why is that so different?
I'd love to jump in here, because that was my like massive confusion when I was setting up a DST fund, because we picked one of the top law firms Actually, the guy, one of our attorneys that was setting this up, actually helped write the tax code on this in 2004. And, you know, they're setting all this up. And I was like getting so confused because they're like, well, you know, the diligence team is going to want to see this and they're going to want to see that. And this is like typical and this is market. And I was like, can I just clarify something for a second? We're unique, right? Because we're not going through a broker dealer. We're not having a institutional shop like farm this out and raise money.
Give you, like, and give you money.
Correct. Because at the end of the day, this is a 506C offering. This is a syndication, right? It's just in a structure that is a DST. So what makes Spartan a little unique is we're not getting charged back the broker dealer fee that gets charged to the project. It's usually 8 to 10%, you know, and that's fine. That's it. You know, people got to get paid and I get that. But we're going direct to our retail investor network. We're not going through a broker dealer to sell this. And so typically, Tate, my understanding, and Trevor, I'd love to hear your background on this, you know, is that it's typically done through a broker dealer like Tate was talking about. It's typically a financial advisor or, you know, whatever it might be, kind of selling this stuff. So we were getting confused in the process because it's so typical to go through a broker dealer on it. So Trevor, I'd love.
Yeah, that's great context, Ryan. And I certainly understand the confusion. What I will say, until probably a year and a half or 2 years ago, I had not seen a 506C DST offering. They were all 506B offerings, which require, I mean, these are sections of the Securities Act that nobody needs to fully understand. But what that means, if the offering is listed or is released as a 506B exemption, that means that the advisor that puts you into the investment has to have a pre-existing relationship with you. So an advisor like me would have to have a relationship with the client in order to recommend the DST that I'm recommending. About, like I said, a year and a half or 2 years ago, there, through a number of other securities regulations that have impacted this, there's a rule called contemplation, which you may have come across, Ryan, but it's pushing this rule called contemplation that forces us, even if we have existing relationships, if we earn the relationship through a public source, we can't recommend anything that's currently available. And so to get around that rule, a lot of sponsors have been reclassifying or reevaluating and offering these DSTs under 506C, which permits us to generally solicit. So now we can actually advertise the offering. We can talk to a client that's procured through a public source, like an internet lead or a website. We can talk to them about existing offerings without violating that contemplation rule. So I see the trend of the industry kind of going more to the 506C. So I expect more sponsors, Ryan, like Spartan, will follow suit, and it may lead to more direct relationships with the sponsor. What I like to do, and the value that an advisor in my position will always bring, is I push diversification. Like we talked about at the beginning, I prefer to put $1 million or a $2 million exchange into 5 to 7 different DST properties. You might have one, Ryan, but where do we find the other 6? So with my relationships, I can put them in, 6 of the other DST properties we want to be in through the 15 or so sponsor relationships I have, and give that client a full service diversified portfolio of DSTs to complete their exchange.
Love it. Yeah. And that's a huge value add that you bring. And we were kind of coming back in through the other way with just being like, hey, you know, we don't really know what advisors to go talk to, you know, to really do this. But what we do have is a network of investors that want to invest in our projects. So we sort of took a different approach to it, but it was kind of confusing getting to that conclusion, you know, working with a law firm to set up the DST that is familiar and typically works, you know, in conjunction with somebody who's having it sold by a broker dealer. So, huge, huge value add to that. I want to stress that. And you are extremely knowledgeable, Trevor. I'm so glad we have you on the show. This is great. I'm a pilot and so deep in the weeds here on this stuff. This is awesome. Love it. So
yeah, it's really great.
Well, no kids, Tate. I heard you're Stan's children as well. That gives us a little extra time to into our interests.
Exactly. No kidding. Well, speaking of, I got to run and give a line check. I'm going to let you guys stay on, and I have one more question that I want to ask, and then I'm going to throw my headset off and go fly an airplane. What about cash investors? Can cash investors go into a DST? Because we've talked about 1031 exchange money going in, but if someone sees, you know, Spartan's DST offering and they think, well, I don't have a 1031 exchange, but you know, it looks good. I'd like to invest in it anyway. Can I invest in it through with cash, my self-directed IRA, that sort of stuff?
Yeah, great question. And I get queried from clients all the time who are interested in just making a cash investment in a DST. I think the couple of drawbacks of the DST are some of the limitations around growth that we talked about. So for someone looking for a lot of growth, if you're not performing a 1031 exchange, it's probably not the most suitable option for that investor. And so for that reason, primarily, just the suitability of what are the investor's objectives, it might be a blocker. Having said that, if the customer is at a point where they just want to generate predictable income, absolutely. You know, we would present a solution that includes a cash investment in a DST to that customer, because you get all the benefits of direct real estate ownership. You get the pass-through and depreciation, of course, the mortgage interest deduction, and we still preserve the 1031 exchange ability once we sell that DST asset. So that investor can go on to perform another or a subsequent 1031 exchange, roll those proceeds into either a new DST or a direct title option, whatever they prefer. But those options are still preferred under the are preserved under the DST structure. So there are occasions, but usually a cash investor where we're opening the aperture up to include other syndications that may fire on more growth cylinders, we'd probably start the conversation with those options.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, because of the restrictions that you said, you can't refinance this, you can't add additional capital, you can't do some heavy value add lifting on it. So, you know, unless you're just looking for kind of a steady cash flowing investment that is unlikely to have a capital call and need additional reserves and things like that, you know, maybe that might be the best option, but there's a lot of other options out there as well. Depreciation. Yep. You still can take depreciation benefits from a DST, no?
Absolutely. In fact, that's one of the biggest drivers here. And what we see in a lot of exchanges, if a investor is selling a commercial property, so your listeners may know that if it's a non-residential commercial property, we're depreciating that asset over 39 years. However, residential property, so if it's multifamily or considered a commercial residential property, we get an abbreviated depreciation schedule of 27 and a half years. So when the investor rolls into a DST portfolio, we'll evaluate if they have basis remaining. So remember, we can only depreciate our investment down to zero. So they have to have basis remaining in order to take the depreciation deduction. But if we see they have basis remaining, we can put them into a portfolio that's biased towards multifamily, which will allow them the accelerated depreciation schedule of 27 and a half years. And just like they would report income from a direct title option, they're going to report this income on the Schedule E of their tax return to show the income and then the deductions, which would include the depreciation they are entitled to take.
Yeah, that's great. Because a lot of times investors will say, or a syndicator might say, like, well, you know, you don't need a 1031 because you can just come into my deal and I'll give you the depreciation and then I'll offset some of your gain. But with a 1031 investor going into a DST, not only do you defer that gain, but then you get additional depreciation on top of that. And I think that's often a nuance that's super overlooked. That's a big deal. because it could be like 20 to 30% of additional tax deferment on top of the tax deferment of the complete proceeds of the sale. So hugely beneficial to the investor. And I wanted to highlight that. RDST.
I will.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, so I will add to that. Just you know, this might be too technical, but the other solution we might look for with the client, I had mentioned that we can only depreciate down to a zero basis. So if we've depreciated away our basis, our depreciation is finished at that point. So in the DST, however, we actually have some tools to give that client additional basis. So for example, if a client is selling $1 million property with no debt on it, and their basis is $0 because they've depreciated away, let's say they own the asset for 30 years and their depreciation has eliminated now all of their basis. So they've got $1 million property. It would be $1 million gain. And they perform a Section 1031 exchange into a DST. If we elect to replace that relinquished property with a DST that has debt in place, and this, let me know, Ryan, if I lose you in this explanation,
I'm loving it.
the replacement DST, let's just assume there's a single DST that they're purchasing. If that property in the DST has debt in place, the investor gets credit for that debt. So let's assume, as an example, that they're buying a DST that has 50% loan to value. So when they're moving their $1 million of proceeds into the replacement DST, they're investing $1 million, but what they're actually buying is $2 million worth of real estate, because 50% of debt is credited to that investor, and then the other 50% is the equity they're contributing. Well, guess what? That investor just bought a $2 million asset from a $1 million asset. That difference, so the two minus the one, is another $1 million in basis that investor just accrued, which returns some of the tax efficiency because we can now depreciate that additional basis that we just gave the customer. So it's a very important tool as we evaluate their entire exchange. Where are we able to provide some tax efficiency, not just through the exchange, but in the DST portfolio that they're building as a replacement solution?
Yeah, no, that's great. And can we touch on debt in general? So our DST that we're actually rolling out doesn't have any debt on it. Can you talk through some of the, I mean, obviously the pros here are going to be things like, you know, more free cash flow, less risk, lower break-even occupancy, less chance of a spring out, right? Because we don't have the debt considerations. But kind of speak to some more of the pros and cons that maybe I'm not tracking.
Yeah. So the biggest con in your case, Ryan, and in any all cash DST, is going to be the debt replacement problem that the investor will face in the 1031 exchange. So we talked about the 1031 exchange at a high level, but something important to understand is there's something called the exchange equation. And it's the equation we use to plan the exchange to ensure that the client is going to achieve a full tax deferral through the exchange. And the two things that have to occur in the exchange are, number one, for a full deferral, again, we can do partial exchanges, but if we're seeking a full tax capital gain tax deferral, the first thing that has to happen is we have to reinvest all the proceeds. So if we sell $1 million asset, there's $100,000 worth of closing costs, we're left with $900,000. We have to invest the $900,000. Number two is we have to replace all the debt. So if that relinquished property had $1 million worth of debt on it, let's again assume that in this case, the relinquished property was a $2 million property. It had $1 million worth of debt on it. we have to now replace that $1 million worth of debt that we retired on the relinquished property. If we don't, the IRS considers that mortgage boot. So we're getting debt relief and they're going to treat that as taxable boot. So if the investor we're seeking in our DST is coming to us with debt, they're going to have to find a way to replace the debt if your DST isn't going to do it for them. And you can replace debt with new cash. So they might have to come to the table with additional cash in order to achieve a full tax deferral. But that problem we work with, we have calculators galore to walk through this stuff with the client's CPA and make sure that we eliminate the appropriate transaction costs that are disallowed under the exchange. And certainly making sure we're buying enough real estate is paramount. So those two exchange equation rules I gave, reinvest all the proceeds and replace all the debt, they basically boil down to the client has to buy as much or more real estate than they're selling.
Gotcha.
So regardless of how the capital stack looks, if you sell a $2 million property, you have to buy $2 million worth of property. So that's the only thing I would mention to a sponsor who's considering an all-cash offering. We love them. We include them in portfolios. We don't have any debt challenges or risks associated with debt. But the bad part of that is we're narrowing the scope of investors that may be able to complete an exchange with that product.
Yeah. And it's not that they couldn't complete it. It's just that they're going to have to pay the tax on that. Right. That's kind of
they'd either pay the tax or come to the table with cash to replace the debt with new cash. Yep.
Yeah. Well, great. Well, Trevor, we've taken a lot of your time and I just want to say, we want to have you back on the show because this was awesome. And I feel like we could dive into opportunity zones and a bunch of other things, but I just really wanted to say thank you for coming on and walking through this. This has been really helpful for me, who is literally right in the middle of a hunt to do a DST. So we're offering our webinar tonight. So I've actually picked up a few things from this. So this has been selfishly awesome. So thank you for that.
Well, yeah, no, I appreciate the invitation. Honored to be here. I certainly love what you guys are doing. I think was it Adam Smith who talked about specialization and divisional labor here? As our industry gets big, you guys are addressing a very gaping knowledge gap, I think, that we have as pilots, where we have a huge W-2 income and we have to look for ways to manage our money, but in a tax efficient way. And you guys are doing a great job bringing knowledge to that group. So thanks for that.
Yeah, you're welcome. And can you tell us how listeners can get in touch with you or learn more about you or connect?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find me on LinkedIn, Trevor Flor, F-L-O-R is my last name, or you can reach out to me by email. My email is trevorf@daisecurities.com. That's Delta Alpha India Securities.com. So I'm always happy to answer questions. If someone is considering a 1031 exchange where they're not even considering DSTs or may not be suitable for DSTs, certainly happy to speak to that individual. I've got a robust network of CPAs and attorneys that I can refer out if there's a complicated exchange we need to seek legal or tax advice. So happy to be a first call for anyone that's considering an exchange.
Well, thanks again, Trevor. And thanks to our listeners for tuning in for another great episode. We'll catch you on the next one. Thank you.
Thanks, Ryan.